Lonnie is the founding director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History. And he's also served as the president of the Chicago Historical Society, and he's also worked in various capacity at the Smithsonian Institution prior to this for more than a dozen years, including associate director for curatorial affairs and senior curator of political history at the National Museum of American History. Welcome.
Now you know there is nothing more dangerous than giving historians a microphone and a captive audience. Let me begin with a poem. I'm a believer that you can tell every story in American history through the poetry of Langston Hughes. So let me begin with a poem by Langston Hughes. There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say. On my heartstrings, freedom sings all day, every day. There are words like liberty that almost make me cry. If you had known what I know, you would know why. In many ways, the era of the modern civil rights movement, which some say begins with Brown versus Board of Education, some say it begins with when Jackie Robinson integrated baseball. But what's important is that what this movement really wanted to do in a simple way was the search for simple justice. They were in search of ways to help the public see and understand what Langston Hughes has written, what the black community had known for generations, that there was a profound and fundamental clash between the stated ideals of American values of liberty and justice and the realities of American racial politics. In a way, the civil rights movement wanted all Americans to know what a woman that I've come to know very well knew as a 15-year-old in 1955. In recent years, historians and now the media has rediscovered Claudette Colvin. Claudette Colvin was a 15-year-old girl in Montgomery, Alabama, who was arrested in March of 1955 for breaking the segregation laws by refusing to give up her seat on a bus. While there has been much discussion about where Ms. Colvin fits in the scheme of history, is she as important as Rosa Parks because she was arrested months earlier? I would argue that what is most interesting to me is not so much that whether or not Mrs. Colvin deserves to be patted on the back because she was arrested sooner, but rather because of the reasons why she did what she did. Because unlike Rosa Parks, Claudette Colvin did not have a support network. She did not have a strategy to effect change. She just knew that now was the time. And when I talked to her recently, I asked her, "Don't tell me the story of your arrest. Tell me why. Why would a 15-year-old girl risk going to jail in Montgomery, Alabama, not knowing at all who would come to her aid?" She told an amazing story. She said that as a 15-year-old, she remembered that when she was 13, a boy in her neighborhood, a 17-year-old boy, had been doing the unthinkable. He was sneaking around dating white women. Well, when the police found out, he was arrested for serial rape, put in prison, and in fact, in 1958, electrocuted. Mrs. Colvin reminded me that she said, "I remembered as I sat on that bus, I remembered that story, and I wondered about fairness in America." And then she said that she had also just gone through Black History Month Even though it was only Black History Week or Negro History Week, in her school, they did a month in 1955. And she said for the first time, she learned of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. And she learned that there had been a history of struggle for change and equality. But then she added something that I really didn't expect. She said the other thing that really motivated her to do this, remember, she is arrested in March of 55, was that the last day of February, the teacher decided they were going to do current events. And they did the story of the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya. And she had never heard the phrase freedom fighter before. So she said to me that she was sitting on this bus, knowing that she should give up her seat. And all of that was floating through her mind. And in some ways, I would argue that her rationale helps us understand so much what the civil rights movement tried to accomplish, and it helped us understand the process through which people as diverse as Martin Luther King or Fannie Lou Hamer or the unnamed sharecropper went through. First of all, this desire to find this sense of fairness and justice. Most of this movement was motivated by simple things, by the simple inequities that seemingly needed to be called into question in this supposedly free America. But also, what Ms. Colvin really helped us remember, what shaped so much of the civil rights movement, was a profound belief in America. There was not an attempt to say that we hate this country. There was not an attempt to say that America was fatally flawed. But rather, there was a desire to suggest that if we could only find ways to help America live up to its ideals, live up to its stated notion of equality, of liberty, and justice. And that is why it was so important in the civil rights movement to always quote those founding documents, to find the pieces that say, this is the best part of America. And what we're doing is simply asking America to remember to be America. And I think the third piece that comes out of Mrs. Colvin's memories is a recognition, a smart and strategic recognition, that these changes occurred within a global context. And that in some ways, the key to success was visibility. The need to illuminate all the dark corners of the American experience so that the pressures and the propaganda of the Cold War could help contribute to a changed America. So in some ways, what is it that we take from the civil rights movement? What is it that works so well? What worked less well? And what are the contemporary parallels? Well, it seems to me another person that I've always been so moved by was someone in Chicago named Mabee Mobley, who was the mother of Emmett Till. And she spent a lot of time talking to me when I was president of the Chicago Historical Society. And she said, as she told the story of the murder of her son, who was murdered 50 years ago last summer, she said, "What worries me most is not that Americans will forget, but in some ways, like David talked about, but how Americans will remember." She was very concerned that Americans wouldn't remember the strategy, the courage, the creativity of the civil rights movement. But more importantly, she felt, she worried that Americans wouldn't remember that this was a continuing struggle, not something that had been achieved. And so in some ways, when we think about the civil rights movement, it's hard for many to remember just how strong the walls of segregation were. Hard to remember just how many Americans accepted the notions of the inherent racial inferiority of Black Americans. It's hard to remember that songs like Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit really reflected the racial violence, the intimidation, and the despair that were a normal part of life for millions of Americans. It is difficult to remember the way that poll taxes and literacy tests and intimidation prevented generations from exercising the freedom to vote. And it's hard to recall just how few African Americans had access to quality education, or just how few were able to escape either the unrelenting poverty of the Jim Crow South or the concrete ghettos that trapped those who fled the South in earlier eras. In some ways, the civil rights movement is important in part because of who it brought together. It brought together an array of allies, from liberals to union members, from Democratic politicians who suddenly realized that as blacks moved north, their vote had power, to thousands of young Americans who saw in the civil rights movement opportunities for leadership that traditionally had been denied. And that this coalition was led by an array of personalities, many African American, who personally felt the pain of racial hatred and discrimination. Some were motivated like Fannie Lou Hamer, who was simply sick and tired of being sick and tired. While others were influenced by the rhetoric of freedom and opportunity that stemmed from the Second World War and from the words of the Cold War. While others were moved by a spiritual and moral compass that wondered why the fault line of race was so clear and so strong in America. But what they really had in common, and what is one of, I think, the most important things one takes from the civil rights movement, was a belief that not only the change was needed, but the change was possible. What I think we forget, and what we need to marvel at, is that one of the most amazing things of the civil rights movement is people were able to imagine an America that they had never seen. Imagine an America where blacks had political power. Imagine an America where supposedly equality was just around the corner. A world that they neither experienced, but they could imagine. While this loose coalition differed on specific remedies and on the means to the end, they all agreed that this movement sought in different ways to make manifest simple justice and to reveal our common humanity. In some ways, the civil rights movement really focused on four areas with very differing levels of success. Obviously, one of the most important and one of the most visible was the struggle for political rights, the major focus of which was the vote, the belief that by acquiring the vote, African Americans could protect their economic opportunities, protect their families, and really have the full rights of being a citizen. Thus, the activities of groups like SNCC and others in the early 60s spent a great deal of time on voter registration. For me, it became clear when I was sent to Mississippi as a 14-year-old by my mother to experience the Freedom Summer of 1964. She thought it was important for her children to have that experience. And we went down to Mississippi, and we went to these roads and these homes to register people to vote. But my strongest memory is not the challenge of registering people to vote. The fondest memory is sitting in these homes, listening to people tell me how important it was not to win, but the struggle. And in some ways, this notion of the struggle itself being part of the goal is something that motivated so many who were involved in this struggle for civil rights. Secondly, the challenge for educational justice. The African American community always believed in the centrality of education, in the importance of education as a means for racial uplift. In the years after World War II, so many suits were initiated to get rid of Jim Crow schools or to improve the lot of those who went to those schools, whether it was through the efforts of the NAACP and many others. But what's important is, and one of the challenges that we have to wrestle with today, is what was the impact of all of that change? How profoundly did that change the educational system? And why is it that as we look today, the system of public education that these folks felt was going to be the key to the success of the African American community, these public schools, many have become more resegregated than ever before. But it seems that goal was really one of the most motivating and important factors of the struggle for civil rights. The other piece that is so important, however, was the struggle for equal access. But it really gets to this notion of the role of integration. It's always interesting to me how rarely we use the word integration today. And yet, in the 1960s, integration was key to the success of gathering racial equality. The notion was that Black Americans had been humiliated by the signs and the customs that restricted their access to hotels, to stores, humiliated by the going to back doors to get food or going through Jim Crow doors into separate parts of the train station. It's not surprising that so much attention was focused on this struggle to achieve integration, because for many, integration was synonymous with equality and with citizenship. Until one could eat where others dined, or no longer found themselves restricted to the balconies of movie theaters, or could actually try on clothes at the local department store. Until that happened, African Americans believed that second-class citizenship would always be their lot. Thus, this focus, whether it was the sit-ins of the youths or the freedom riders, the notion was that the battle for integration had to be one of the most important things that really would strike a blow at this America that they wanted to change. But I would argue that the least successful aspect of the civil rights movement was the battle for economic equality. While the struggle for jobs was always a part of this battle, whether it was from Montgomery to Memphis, to the March on Washington, to the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, there was not a cohesive strategy or a consensus on how to achieve that economic opportunity. And in some ways, in the minds of many, economic equality got lost in the shuffle. It was important, but the belief was if we could knock down the walls of segregation, then the doors of economic opportunity would flow open. But the truth is that while most of the obvious manifestations of racism were addressed, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the open house legislation of 68, the challenge of economic opportunity has proven to be the greatest difficulty and really the greatest challenge left before us as we wrestle with the legacy of the civil rights movement. As Lyndon Johnson said in 1967, freedom is not enough. You do not wipe away the scars of centuries by saying, now you are free, go on and do what you desire. So in some ways, the civil rights movement was this wonderful time of great passion, great commitment, important successes, and significant failings and disappointments that resonate to this very day. While this was a war that led to many victories, many of the most obvious manifestations of racism were addressed or made visible. No longer were the walls of Jim Crow supported by the legal system. While the attitudes did not change overnight, the belief was that the changes put in place would lead to a new kind of America, an America that Martin Luther King called his beloved community, an America where justice would rain down, an America where equality would be a central value of who we were. I would argue one of the great strengths of the civil rights movement, and one of the things that's missing today, is that the civil rights movement created an atmosphere of possibility, an atmosphere of promise that stimulated change. In other words, in the late 1960s, many things seemed possible. Integration seemed just around the corner. The dramatic, invisible change in black and white relations really began to stimulate other changes, whether it's in the status of women, the Chicano movement, the American Indian movement. All of this drew sustenance and support from the civil rights movement. And I think another important success of this movement was the new cadre of leaders that were drawn from the black church and as well from younger organizations like SNCC. People that to this day still shape what we do, like John Lewis or Julian Bond, and others that are no longer here, like Ella Baker or Mamie Mobley, really shape dramatically what we are and what we're able to accomplish. But I would argue the greatest failing is the inability to have a great impact on the class differences. While there was clearly a successful black middle class that came out of this movement, and that the gaps between black and white narrowed in education, income, and access to skilled employment, yet the median wealth of white Americans far surpassed that of black Americans, and more black children to this day continue to live in poverty. So the question really is before us, as we look at the civil rights movement in its strengths and its weaknesses, in its successes and its failures, what are the challenges we face today? I think in some ways, it really goes to a simple question. Is race still the fault line that divides us and endangers us? Or has this movement changed us enough so that we've got a different equation when it comes to the centrality of race? I would argue that today the challenge is even greater because it's no longer a world that's simply black and white. It's a multicultural, a diverse world. But the question is, does that mean that African-American experience in the civil rights movement becomes one of many experiences? Or is it still a central and an instructive experience that helps us shape who we are? In some ways, do we still wrestle with this dichotomy of integration versus separation that in a simplistic way was reflected in a difference between a Martin Luther King and a Malcolm X? In one way, I think what's really important that the civil rights movement left us with is the notion, how do we centralize race? By that I mean, how do we make sure that race isn't seen as something that other people have, that it's simply an African-American story, but that rather it's something that profoundly shapes who we are as Americans, whether you came in this country in 1820, 1920, or 20 minutes ago. It's important to reflect how today race still shapes who we are. I would leave you with two other thoughts. One is that one of the great unfinished parts of this revolution is really the opportunity to give all people access to the American dream. And it really came home to me. I'm commuting between Chicago and D.C. And yesterday, I gave a talk in the west side of Chicago, which was where Martin Luther King lived 40 years ago this year when he led his march to Chicago. And as I was walking to the neighborhood with several journalists, a bunch of people came up to us and asked what we were doing, and I said, we're retracing where King lived. And a man looked me in the eye and he said, that made a difference in a lot of places, but I can't see what difference it made right here where I live today. And in some ways, the challenge before us is how do we open a window so that not just a few, but many, reap that benefit of really what was a civil rights movement was all about. And finally, it seems to me, what the civil rights movement does for us is that it really is this wonderfully unforgiving mirror. It's a mirror that still allows us to hold it up, to explore, and to test how we're doing, to see how close we are to living up to those ideals in our stated founding documents. In some ways, what the civil rights movement reminds us today is that it's not enough to say it's better, but that the challenge before us is to try to find that beloved community that Martin Luther King so sought. And in some ways, what the civil rights movement does for us is, as Robert Kennedy said, it created these ripples of hope, ripples that began to change the world. And our goal, our challenge, is to make sure those ripples haven't died. Thank you very much.